Welcome, members and guests, to the February 6th program, February 13th program of the City Club of Eugene, When Heroes Are Not Welcomed Home. Thank you for joining us. Greetings to our broadcast television and radio audience. I'm Marlene Nesri, City Club President. Our sponsors today are Sacred Earth Botanicals, Capella Market, Eugene's neighborhood grocer, and Dot Dotson Photography, imaging experts for over 80 years. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and also for archiving the podcasts. Thanks as well to the staff of Fertilab Thinkubator for hosting teachers and a recent session of our career course, which is a project of City Club, Lane Workforce Partnership, and Lane ESD. Welcome to returning members Susan Sowards, Mike Cowles, and Jill Overly. A quick reminder that we host nearly 50 nonpartisan issue programs a year. If you believe with us that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please do join us. We welcome donors, sponsors, members, volunteers, and students, anyone who has a stake in community life. We also welcome your contributions to our new special events fund. Planning has begun for our exciting launch this spring, a program with the first female justice of the United States Supreme Court, the Honorable Sandra Day O'Connor. Look for more details in coming weeks. Today's programs, When Heroes Are Not Welcomed Home, is coordinated by Marty Wilde. Our speakers today are Linda Tamura and Doug Crispin. Linda Tamura is an author and emerita professor of education at Willamette University in Salem. Her book, Nisei Soldiers Break Their Silence, shares the stories of World War II soldiers, second-generation Japanese Americans from Hood River, who served in the U.S. Army overseas while their parents and siblings were imprisoned in relocation camps here at home. Tamura's traveling exhibit, What If Heroes Were Not Welcomed Home, is at the Lane County Historical Museum through the end of February. Doug Crispin is a career park ranger. Doug has worked for both Oregon State Parks and the National Park Service. 36 years ago, he began dating a park ranger who was of Japanese-American descent. They got married standing at the rim of the Grand Canyon and have lived together in Eugene for the past 21 years. Doug's family connections began his interest in Japanese-American history. In particular, Doug wanted to learn and understand what happened to his in-laws during and after World War II, as well as to Japanese Americans living in Eugene. Please welcome Linda Tamura and Doug Crispin.
Thanks so much for inviting us to participate in your Asian celebration in Eugene this week. I'm proud to be an Asian American. Now, at least. But that wasn't always the case. I was the only Asian American in my grade school, and I didn't see anyone who looked like me in my school textbooks. And the first week of school, the cook kept me in during noon hour because I couldn't eat the rice pudding. But I'd never had rice with sugar and cream and raisins in it. And in my history classes, we studied the Oregon Trail and Western civilizations, but nothing about my heritage. So it was a shock when, as an adult, I happened to be in the basement of my county library and looked at back issues of the local newspaper. It was 1945, during World War II. And the headline of a full-page newspaper ad in black letters said, "Japs are not wanted in Hood River." Underneath were dozens and dozens of names of local citizens, including people I knew and a former teacher. My hometown had secrets, and I was horrified. So I asked questions, often unwelcome, about my family heritage, about Japanese Americans, and I began an inquiry into my community, my state, and my country. That actually ties in to next Thursday, which is the Day of Remembrance. 73 years ago, after Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, our country determined that those of Japanese descent were dangerous, even though there were no acts of sabotage. On February 19, 1942, President Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066 that led to the forced removal of 120,000 of Japanese American descent. Two-thirds of them were born in this country. They were American citizens. Yet 22,500 young sons also served in our nation's armed forces, and among them were my father and my uncle. 3 years later, in 1945, near the end of the war, my hometown campaigned to prevent its citizens of Japanese descent from returning home after the war. More than 1,800 signed petitions that appeared in a series of 6 full-page ads. And the message was clear. Japanese were not welcome to return home. There was one particular incident, however, that gained national notoriety. The citizens had erected an honor roll in the downtown area along the wall of the county courthouse. And they put up the names of more than 1,800 young men and women who were serving in the military. On the evening of November 29, 1944, the names of 16 were blotted out, and all were Japanese Americans. The media across the country took my hometown to task, including the New York Times, the Chicago Sun, Colliers, with headlines such as "Dirty Work at Hood River," "Not So American," "Hood River's Blunder." GIs in Europe and the South Pacific wrote letters, as did citizens across the country. And then in January 1945, Frank Hachia, a local Japanese American, died in the Philippines, after he had volunteered for a heroic mission to go behind enemy lines to interrogate a Japanese prisoner of war. So now I understood why my parents, my neighbors, and even my teachers were cautious about bringing up the past, and why my community avoided opening up a can of worms. But time did bring changes. In 1988, with the passage of our Civil Liberties Act, our country admitted it had made a huge mistake. A grave injustice, it called it, to Americans and aliens of Japanese ancestry. More important to me, though, is what can we learn from our past? Our exhibit, "What If Heroes Were Not Welcome Home," at your Lane County Historical Museum, asked the question that I actually didn't begin asking until I was an adult. What would you do if you saw George Akiyama, a veteran wearing his uniform with its medals, going into a barbershop with the barber telling him, with his shaking his razor, "I ought to slit your throat"? What would you do? Or today, if you saw someone treated unfairly, or bullied, or heard a racist, sexist, homophobic, or religious joke, what would you do? What would you say? My heroes, even in my hometown's hostile climate, for those who step forward for the rights of others, despite potential repercussions for themselves. R.J. McIsaac, the store owner who sold Japanese goods, even though others put up signs outside his windows calling him a Jap lover. Arlene Moore, who owned a business downtown, and even though she walked with a cane, she took grocery lists from my grandparents and others who weren't able to shop because the store owners wouldn't let them inside. Captain Sheldon Lawrence, who walked up a hill 2.5 miles covered with snow so he could knock on the door of George Akiyama and apologize for the actions of the barber. And then he wrote a letter to the Oregonian that was published in 1945, decrying the actions of unjustified insults to what he called some of the nation's best fighting men. These are people of goodwill who took time to look at all sides of the issue and then had the courage to speak out when others were treated unfairly. 70 years after the end of World War II, our country is more diverse than ever. In fact, this year in our schools, more than one-third of the students in our schools are students of color. We have made many mistakes in our history, and apologies do help. But let's begin now. My question is, what can we learn from our past, especially from positive role models in our history? Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. My name is Doug Crispin. I'm here representing myself and my family. I want to talk about three things this afternoon. I want to talk about the University of Oregon experience and the time immediately after Pearl Harbor attack. I want to talk about my family's experience, what happened to them during the war, and reconciliation and healing. It was, as Linda said, exactly 73 years ago next week that Executive Order 9066 was issued by President Roosevelt, ordering the evacuation of all the Japanese folks of Japanese ancestry off the West Coast. Japanese folks are here on the West Coast represented about 1% of the population, but this did affect over 100,000 people. So what was going on at the University of Oregon right at this time period? 1942, the general enrollment was 3,100 approximately, and about 100 were graduate students. Of those 3,200 students, 20 were Japanese American, and one was a Japanese international exchange student going to school in Eugene here. And the evacuation notice hit in February. In March, there was a curfew placed in effect on all of the folks of Japanese ancestry, where you're basically under house arrest. You weren't allowed out on the street after 8 p.m. On March 11th, another executive order was issued, and hardly any of the historians know about this. This is Executive Order 9095 under the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917, which created an Office of Alien Property. This organization was set aside to seize the assets of enemy and enemy aliens. So if you were a Japanese immigrant and were restricted from gaining your citizenship because of anti-Asian laws at the time, that you could lose your property. It could be held, used, administered, liquidated, sold, otherwise dealt with in the interest and the benefit of the United States. This was in effect in World War I. The executive order reinstituted it towards the folks of Japanese ancestry in World War II. So in March, if you were a student, March 1942, a student at the University of Oregon, you were faced with problems of getting finances if your parents were not U.S. citizens and had their assets seized by the government. How are you going to get your money to go to school? And then you're also facing a deadline of just a few months where you have to get kicked out of university and you have to leave the West Coast completely. So those were facing the students in March. So here's where one person and two organizations entered the picture. Carl Onthank was University of Oregon graduate in 1913. And starting in 1916, he served for 41 years in various administrative capacities at the university. And in 1942, happened to be the Dean of Personnel Administration. Do we have a relative of him here today? Okay. And then the second thing that entered the picture was the Young Men's Christian Association, YMCA, established in 1840 with the goals of healthy body, mind, and spirit. In 1911, they had a committee on friendly relations amongst foreign students that was part of the outreach of the YMCA. And then the third thing that entered the picture was the Quakers, the American Friends Service Committee, to promote lasting peace with justice as a practical expression of faith in action. That's their mission. And this was after the evacuation, just by a day or so. They established a National Japanese American Relocation Council to help resettle the Japanese American students that ended up in the internment camp. So from March 17th to March 28th of 1942, Dean Onthank wrote a series of letters to the YWCA and the YMCA asking for their help, saying, hey, we have students here that are going to get kicked out of the university in a matter of months. Can you help them find homes and accepting universities across the West outside of the military evacuation zone? We need your help. That's what he wrote. And think about this. He was going to bat for 0.6% of the student population. And he put a lot of effort into this. He also began networking with his peers, his administrative peers in other West Coast universities. How can we get these guys to continue their education? Let's try to get them into an accepting university off of the coast. So from March to May, here's what happened with 19 of those 20 students. 10 of them successfully transferred to inland universities. University of Utah, Minnesota, Colorado, Denver, and even Temple University accepted University of Oregon students. One was accepted in a correspondence class and later ended up at a New York nursing school. So that took care of half the students. 9 of them were forced out of school eventually that spring, and I don't know what happened to them. March 27th was the deadline where all of the folks of Japanese ancestry had a report to the civil control station here in Eugene, just a few blocks away on 34th West 6th Street, where the Holt Center is. But March 31st was the actual graduation day for the class of 1942, and there's one student left. Her name was Michi Yasui, also from Hood River. So March 9th, President Erb of the university wrote a letter to the federal authorities asking for an exemption. Is there any chance that we can allow Ms. Yasui to attend her graduation ceremony, even though it's a few days after the evacuation notice? And the answer came back, no. And not only that, but the graduation was scheduled to be after 8 p.m., so she, technically, you know, she couldn't even leave her dorm room. That was not allowed. So what happened on graduation day 1942? She was not permitted to attend. She was basically under house arrest, locked down in her dorm room, 3 blocks away from Mack Court, where the graduation ceremony occurred. Evacuation notice took effect. As Linda said, 110,000 to 120,000 folks of Japanese ancestry were evacuated off the West Coast, 3,600 from Oregon, 555 from Linda's hometown of Hood River, and two-thirds, as she mentioned, were U.S. citizens. that were forcibly removed off the West Coast. So once that happened, then the Friends group kicked in, a Friends Society, the Quakers, through the Japanese National Japanese American Student Relocation Council. And what's the report card? How many of those students were they able to get out of the internment camps? They had huge success. 4,000 students were successfully resettled into over 600 institutions. So that was a good report card. Now, what happened with my family right after the Pearl Harbor attack? Well, my father-in-law, Frank Sakamoto, was a student. He was also in his senior year at the University of Utah. And just like any good American, the day after Pearl Harbor, he went down to the local recruitment office with his college buddies to sign up for the armed forces. They took all of his buddies, but they didn't take him, saying there's no place in the service for you as a Japanese American. You were the face of the enemy. So he was devastated by that until he opened up the mail a month later. And guess what? Now the government wanted him. They drafted his behind. So they wanted him a month later. So he served very proudly in the 442nd, the all Japanese American Nisei second generation soldier outfit that was put together with segregated military during World War II. And late October, he was in France with all of his Nisei military outfit buddies. And he was involved in a five-day battle to rescue the Lost Battalion of 211 Texas soldiers that were surrounded completely by the Germans. And after five fierce days of fighting, the 211 soldiers were rescued, but at great cost of 252 casualties from the Japanese American soldiers, 54 that were killed and wounded, killed in action, 42 that were either missing or captured, and 156 that were wounded, including my father-in-law, who lost part of his nose and part of his front teeth. Just in the fighting alone, during the month of October in France, this Japanese American outfit suffered 800 casualties, were awarded three Congressional Medals of Honor, and one presidential unit citation. By the end of the war, 14,000 or so Japanese American men served in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. 650 were killed in action. That's a 4.6% mortality rate. And look around next to you. Look to the person on your left, person on your right. Imagine you were in the 442nd during the war. Well, the person on your right, the person on the left are going to be wounded if you're not, because they suffered 9,500 Purple Hearts were issued. That's a 68% chance that you're going to be suffer a wound during World War II. 21 Congressional Medals of Honors were issued for my father-in-law's outfit and 8 presidential units of unit citations, 4,000 Bronze Stars, 560 Silver Stars. So after the war, after being wounded, he suffered, recuperated for a full year in a hospital, resettled in Chicago, and lived a quiet life, suffering with his war wounds his whole adult life. My mother-in-law, Helen Yamamoto, who was the architect of the Pearl Harbor attack. Anybody know who that was? What was his name? Not too good being a Japanese American living in LA with a name, surname Yamamoto. Well, her father said, "We're not going to the camps. We didn't do anything wrong." So they voluntarily, these are air quotes I'm making, voluntarily relocated inland away from the military evacuation zone. My mother-in-law in the ninth grade and the family of six went to New Mexico and spent part of the war years here and eventually ended up in Chicago. Now, before they were evacuated out of Los Angeles, based on the Executive Order 9095, the government seized $2,700 of his business account, her father's business account. He ran a little pool hall in Los Angeles. And after the war, tried to get his assets back and was denied. The value of his business loss. Just of the cash in his checking account would be $62,000 today that he lost, and the family never got that back. Yamamoto met Sakamoto. They got married, and thank goodness they had two beautiful daughters, and I was lucky to meet one and marry her today. So that's my family connection. You know, this is a terrible story, and it's very depressing, and it's a dark part of our American history. But I don't want to end on the negative, because one thing that's great about America, you know, if we make mistakes, we do have the opportunity. We often admit those mistakes and try to correct them. In 1986, poor old Michi Yasui, stuck in her dorm room, couldn't graduate, was invited back to the University of Oregon to receive her degree. 44 years late, but the University of Oregon made good and invited her back. And as Linda mentioned, in 1988, the country, Congress, and the president, who signed the bill, passed the Civil Liberties Act, which was redress. It offered a formal apology letter from the president of the United States, as well as a $20,000 check for all of the survivors of the camps in 1988. I mean, that's unprecedented. As some of our native groups are talking about redress, too. They want a formal apology. The Japanese Americans got theirs in 1988. The first apology letters went out in 1990. And my mother-in-law received hers. I asked to see the letter. She threw it out. It didn't mean anything to her. It was too little, too late. I'm very proud of my summertime organization, National Park Service, because we don't only tell the good stories of American history, but we tell some of our darker stories. In 1992, the National Park Service took over Manzanar internment camp, and later have taken over Minidoka and Tule Lake. Those are preserved under the mission of the National Park Service today. In 2007, on February 19th, our anniversary of the evacuation notice coming up, the Japanese American Art Memorial here in Eugene was dedicated as healing. You have a flyer on your desk or on your tables that tell you a little bit about it. There are two paver bricks at this memorial I want to bring your attention. One is honors Carl Onthank and what he did for the college students as a dean of the university at that time. He's a hero to many of the locals in the Japanese American community for what he did. And then there's a paver for our personal family hero, my father-in-law, Frank Sakamoto. But we're not done with the healing process, because in 2007, the Oregon legislature passed a bill awarding honorary degree to all of the Oregon college students that were kicked out of the public universities. So 19, and in 2008, the next year, 19 of the surviving University of Oregon students or their families received their honorary degrees. Our neighboring university, Oregon State, recognized all 42 of the students that they kicked out, and 22 of those survivors received their honorary degree in 2008. And in 2010, Congress wanted to recognize the action of all of the Nisei soldiers that fought during World War II with awarding of a Congressional Gold Medal, which you're welcome to come up and look at. After the program, with this citation: their commitment and sacrifice in the face of a two-fronted battle against discrimination at home and fascism abroad demonstrated a highly uncommon and commendable sense of patriotism and honor. And it was just earlier this year that Amy Yogi of our local Japanese American community started looking to the Dean Onthank letter writing campaign to help the U of O students. So I want to recognize her. Here's what three different American presidents had to say about this situation in conclusion. When the 442nd Regimental Combat Team came back to Washington, Harry Truman met them in 1946 and said, "You fought not only the enemy, but you fought prejudice, and you have won." The first round of apology letters issued by Republican President George Herbert W. Bush in 1990 said, "We can never fully right the wrongs of the past, but we can take a clear stand for justice. And finally, as the apology letters continued under the Clinton administration, here's what President Clinton had to say to the Japanese American families. "We must learn from our past and dedicate ourselves as a nation to renewing the spirit of equality and our love of freedom. Together, we can guarantee a future with liberty and justice for all." Thank you.
Thank you. Our first questioner today is Professor Dan Titchener from the University of Oregon's Political Science Department and the Wayne Moore Center for Law and Politics. He's published extensively on immigration politics and policy. Dan.
And Doug, for both the powerful message and also for all the, you know, incredibly important research and work you've done on this. And so I guess my main question would be, have we grown as a society? Has our government grown on this issue? And what comes to mind is, on the one side, we can think about civil liberties scholars like Eric Mueller saying, you know, Japanese internment would never happen again. I think every current member of the Supreme Court has denounced the Korematsu decision. Both Presidents Bush and Obama have said, have clarified that the war on terror is not a war on Islam. On the other hand, we have Ashcroft's preventive detention soon after 9/11. We have the ACLU discovering that the FBI targeted mosques in which there were no particular terror suspects for surveillance and infiltration, and we have the tragic news from our headlines recently of three beautiful Arab American kids, Muslim American kids, who were gunned down in North Carolina. So I guess my question is whether you feel like we've grown as a society and whether our government has grown. Thanks.
Well, I can take that real fast. I'm trying to find the actual wording from the Civil Liberties Act, because it did identify the root problem. So three things made up the problem that allowed for this illegal act. It was racial prejudice, wartime hysteria, and lack of political leadership. So as long as we're, in my opinion, is we're diligent in those three parts, including lack attention to political leadership, then I think we're okay as Americans. But we need to eliminate the hysteria, racial prejudice, and we need strong political leadership.
Well, I'm usually an optimist, and but as we look at the newspaper, even this week, the horrific incidents that are occurring, I don't know. I hope that we will continue to be vigilant, as we said, but we, as individuals, sometimes we say that we need to leave it to the government or to other agencies. I think we need to take it upon ourselves, and we need to focus on incidents that we see related to the exhibit, too. What can we do? So if you see an incident, are we open-minded? Are we looking at digging deep for the truth? Are we looking at both sides or many sides? Are we thinking about small steps that we can take? And as a teacher, that's where I think I really look, because often I think we believe that incidents are beyond what our students should address, and that's really where we need to look. Research now shows that infants at the age of 6 months begin to understand differences in gender and diversity. So we need to talk to our kids about incidents that occur. Sometimes we think that they're not old enough, but what can we do? One of the things I'll mention about the exhibit that is now at the Lane County Historical Museum, we wanted to get students engaged. We wanted to get the public engaged. And we asked them, so what would you do? And we gave them a chance to post responses that they might make. And for me, the most poignant ones were evident when families clearly had talked to each other. The statement from the little four-year-old whose mother had or father had written it saying, well, you know, I would just tell them to stop being mean. Well, that might be a brave thing to do, but it's a first step. She's recognizing right and wrong. Or the family who said, Max and his family will stand up. I think there are small steps that we can take. Thanks.
Thank you so much. We'll break for a few minutes now for questions to be formulated and come back in a few minutes.
You're listening to KLCC, NPR for Oregonians, in Eugene, 89.7 FM, KLCC, KLCO Newport, 90.5, KLFR Reedsport, 89.1, and at 88.1, KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
Welcome back to the February 13th City Club program, When Heroes Are Not Welcomed Home. City Club members, please identify yourselves and keep your questions to about 30 seconds each.
Hello, I'm Jane Smith, City Club for a good many years. I actually have two questions. My grandson is Hapa Haole. In Hawaii, that means half white and half something else. That something else is Japanese. And I'm very proud of my grandson, love him a lot. And he will be headed in a year or two to an Oregon university, probably OSU. And I have a question in my mind as to whether he's going to feel comfortable being part American Japanese. Attitudes are long-lasting. His grandfather is a much decorated former member of the 100th Battalion and the 442nd and died several months ago, much loved by his family and other people. And in Hawaii, the whole experience was very different, in some cases better, in some cases worse. But I want to take us back to Hood River, because I've read several books on the subject, and this is what stands out in my mind, that the incarcerated Japanese families were offered 10 cents on the dollar for their property, general stores, houses, and orchards, just weeks before the alien law confiscated all their property. So they either had to take a loss or take their chances. They didn't know how long they would be incarcerated. But I see an economic motivation after the war, I would call it a conspiracy, to deprive those families of those orchards. They didn't get them back. And when you think about what those fruit orchards are worth today, it's a significant loss. So I'd like you to comment on that.
Yeah, first on the economic issue for Hood River, you are right. I just spilled some water. To put it in a nutshell, Hood River was famous even before the 1900s for the quality of its apples. It had won international awards in the 1880s for apples. And So East Coast families sent their Harvard-educated and Ivy League-educated sons to purchase property in Hood River around the 1900s. What they didn't realize was that this property was full of huge trees, and they were very industrious, but in fact, they had to clear the trees. So they hired Japanese immigrants who were working on the railroads to clear those trees for them. But because it was such difficult work, they gave them incentives. If you'll clear 15 acres for me, we'll give you 5 acres yourselves. And it was swampland or marshland or brushland, but land just the same. As a result, the Japanese immigrants, the Issei, owned more property in Oregon, in Hood River, and in other areas. And by 1940, I believe they composed 0.5% of the population. But in fact, their methods of agriculture were producing about 25% of the fruit. So you're right, it definitely was economic. The tough thing for those who own property, like my grandparents, was this was all they had. My grandfather had over 100 acres, and he had to come back. So he told his caretakers, please, just take care of the trees. That's all we have. Please just take care of the trees. So absolutely, in terms of the economic question. Do you want to take the other question?
Well, I can't answer about whether he'll be welcome here in Oregon or not. I hope he would be. But during the evacuation, 34% of the population of the territory of Hawaii was Asian. So they were the racial majority, and a large percentage of that were the Japanese Americans. So there was not a general relocation of the Japanese Americans on the Hawaiian Islands during the war, because they would have lost the workforce. And, you know, you can't remove the majority of the population. Some of the religious leaders, Buddhist priests, teachers, and whatnot, were interred, but the general population was not. And the 100th Battalion, which was all-volunteer Nisei men from the islands, ended up being merged with the 442nd, the mainland Japanese American soldiers, and they did not get along initially, until when they were in training in Mississippi, some of the mainland Japanese soldiers brought their Hawaiian GI buddies to visit nearby internment camps. And then the Japanese American soldiers from the islands got the idea, well, wait a minute, we're all in this thing together. This is terrible. You're fighting for freedom while your family's behind barbed wire. And of course, the battlefield, it broke down all of the barriers, and they became a cohesive unit. And the Congressional Gold Medal is both for the 442nd, the 100th Battalion made up the Hawaiian Japanese Americans, and the Military Intelligence Service folks. Those are the folks that did have Japanese language skills, served in Asia and as interpreters, language interpreters.
I will tell you, I wish your grandson all the best, and I think the university is a wonderful place to be, with people from different backgrounds and persuasions and cultural and political persuasions. Having come from Willamette University, I know that we put much effort in welcoming and celebrating and recognizing diversity. My friend Gordy Toyama is the director of multicultural diverse programs. They recently recognized the Martin Luther King celebration, and this year they focused on Japanese Americans in World War II. So definitely being at a place where there are open-minded faculty and students and people who want to learn, that's an important thing. Good luck.
Hi, Stu Thomas, City Club member, and thank you for your presentation today, both of you. I'll get to my question in just a second, but first, many of you may not know that the U of O's own Lauren Kessler wrote a book a few years ago called Stubborn Twig, which is an excellent source of information about what these people have been talking about. Our question, though, has to do with the loss of the land and the property and so on that your relatives and their families gave up. I don't recall what percentage of that property and land they were able to reacquire when they returned from the camps, if any. And we were wondering if you knew.
I don't know about percentage. I will say that whereas almost 70% of those of Japanese heritage in Oregon returned to their homes after the war, and this is from study, moving to the Midwest, the camps, or from the military service, in Hood River, it was 27%. So many fewer came back. The dilemma in Hood River, as you addressed, is that there were more landowners as well. So if they chose not to return, it was because of fear. It was because they didn't have property. It might have been because neighbors did not welcome them back. And there was great loss. So I don't know about the percentage of loss. I do know with my uncle and grandfather, in fact, even their neighbors came to them and suggested that they leave. So it was very difficult. I credit them with having a lot of perseverance, and I also credit neighbors who were supportive of having a lot of courage.
James Baldock, City Club member since 2012. Our table was wondering what happened after the war. Were they just kind of like, okay, you're free to go back, or was there some, like, when were they compensated for their lost time, if ever, and how did that whole process take place?
No, I'm not as familiar with that. I don't know.
There was an act, and I totally can't remember the name of it now. It was in 1945, I believe, where they could apply for reimbursement. However, that also required that they have paperwork. And after Pearl Harbor and in the haste of leaving, many families had burned, tossed, stored papers and other belongings and did not have them when they returned. So I think that the toughest thing was they came back, as my father and my uncle said, you know, we put our heads low, we tried not to get in the way of other people, we sometimes had to travel 20 miles to buy groceries or to buy farm equipment, we tried to sell our produce, but sometimes the workers wouldn't let us do that, so they just worked hard. I am amazed at what they did and how they persevered and how they just kept going. But I also understand why it was difficult for them to talk about it, because talking about it brought it out into the open, and they simply wanted to get along and to be accepted. And I think that was the dilemma. So they kept quiet, worked hard, and tried to make friends.
John Attic, City Club member since 2003. And the question is, based on your knowledge and your experience, is it possible that something like this could happen again in this country?
Well, that's kind of the question we had before. It certainly is. Hopefully it'll never happen. And, you know, I'm so proud of my summertime organization, the National Park Service, which tells the story, all of the story of America, the good, the bad, or the ugly. And as long as we know the stories of the past, hopefully we never repeat them.
Yeah, I hope, too, that others won't have what happened to me, which was not to hear the stories at all. They're tough stories to hear, they're tough stories to learn, but we need to make those visible so that we understand the mistakes that we made in the past, we understand the challenges in the future, and we need to do what you're doing here today, talking about issues and looking at solutions. That's so important.
John Dolo, City Club member, and I'm still not clear on when they were finally released. Do you know what date that was? I mean, you no longer had to stay in the camps?
Well, you know, some of the folks through that Friends organization were able to leave the camp before the end of the war. They were placed, some of the kids in university, some of them got farming jobs off of the military exemption zone on the West Coast. But I don't know the details of if they were given a bus or a train ticket back to a one-way ticket back to wherever they wanted to go. I know in my family's case, they settled in Chicago, an inland area, and there's a very sizable Japanese-American community there in Chicago that never really went back to the West Coast. And my in-laws, not until their retirement years, did they finally come back to the West Coast.
What did they have to come back to, though? All their property had been confiscated, right?
Well, that's a good point. So, you know, if you lost your farm, you lost your business, like my wife's grandfather did. He had no interest in going back to Los Angeles and living as a Yamamoto in Los Angeles. He did apply in 1946 to receive his $2,700 business checking account that was seized under that executive order. We have the family, the paperwork for that. It was denied, but he tried to get it. But keep in mind, he wasn't a U.S. citizen. You know, he was from Japan, a Japanese immigrant. So in the wartime hysteria, you know, you don't want the enemies living in your country, in America, to have financial resources that they could possibly send back to the enemy. And the same thing happened with the Germans in World War One. Yeah.
Right. Quickly, again, there were three camps in Oregon?
I think there's just one, Tule Lake. Is that in California or is it in Oregon?
Tule Lake.
It's not in Oregon then.
No.
Okay, but there were, 9 or 10 of them around. Minidoka, a lot of the Oregon folks ended up in Minidoka in Idaho. Manzanar is probably the most famous one in the Owens River.
Were there any in Oregon?
No, none that were.
Oh, okay.
No.
There were 10 camps, and before they were ready, Japanese Americans were taken to what they called assembly centers, and there were 20 of those. There was one in Oregon, and that was in Portland, and it was the Pacific Stockyard. So they moved the animals out, and they put planks on the ground and moved the people in. So definitely it was not a friendly place to live. They had fly catching contests to see who could catch the most flies there. It was pretty bad.
I'm Mary Layton, a City Club member since 2006. And following up on a comment you just made a couple of minutes ago, our table had come up already with the question of, do the textbooks, the current adoption, so not just the odd idiosyncratic thing that we might know about, but do any of the major adoptions used in multiple states refer to the fact that this happened and it was not a good idea? And B, I mean, is there any hope in that direction so that we can expect that our children will have actually heard about this because they're reading like 99% of the kids in the country that there was such a thing as an internment camp and we discovered it was the bad thing to do? Any evidence do you know of?
There's a little bit more. One thing I will address is the Common Core standards that are used out in the schools and also the Oregon Social Studies standards. What is important is that the standards focus on investigating history, looking at issues that are controversial, and those are places where schools can make a difference and can encourage students to investigate and to learn by asking questions, by examining primary documents, by interviewing citizens about the war. It's been fun for me to do workshops with teachers because students who are learning this find it intriguing because they can't believe it happened, that there really were camps that were called concentration camps on American soil. And so that's intriguing in itself. So in some ways, it's really an important topic for helping kids to understand the Bill of Rights and what they can do to make change. Thanks for your question.
Paul Thompson, a City Club member for quite a while. We have a civil rights trajectory question, which is similar to what was the question of the first questioner. Think for a second about the barber and the razor and the threat to that soldier returning that you talked about. Today, that would, if it was substantiated, it would probably be prosecuted as a federal hate crime of some kind. So if you kind of join those two points and so on and think about the trajectory, can you comment on the acceptance of Japanese Americans today vis-a-vis that? And if it's improved, then how does that apply to other groups that are kind of being vilified these days? But aren't things improving? And that's what we'd like to have you comment on.
Wow, I hope so. I hope so. What is interesting is, and my uncle used to comment, you know, in a few years they're going to be blue-eyed Japanese Americans, and in fact, that's happening. We're becoming a much more diverse country. We're also becoming a country with much more intermarriage. In fact, the Asian American population now is intermarrying, and by 2050, we're going to look at one out of five. So part of it is that we are becoming much more integrated, we're becoming much more accepting. But when you look at what's happening still with religious persecution, Muslim Americans, Native Americans in this country, we still do it. So I'm sorry, I don't have a definitive answer to your question. My hope is that by talking about it, by thinking about the process that we go through, by being more deliberative about looking at facts and looking at all sides of an issue, and by thinking about how we treat each other, I hope we can make steps that are positive.
Jerry Smith, City Club member. I went to UC Berkeley in the 60s, and I had a friend who was a girl in Tule Lake, and she was mentored by an uncle in art and became an art major at UC Berkeley. Her experience was her Uncle Paul, agitated, saying he didn't want to be a prisoner. And towards the end of the war, he was traded for prisoners and never heard of again. And then when I lived in Honolulu, I was friends with a Buddhist bishop who was a young boy, and his father before him was the senior bishop. And towards the end of the war, they were traded for American prisoners. They returned and remained in a strong liberal interfaith connections there in Hawaii, but their experience had been worse than you might imagine. They not only had they been traded, but their ship had been reported sunk, and the families had a memorial service for them, and they came home. I don't see how any reparations anybody can get can really be fair for those kind of terrible losses. How about you? What do you think about that? What should happen to families that undergo those kind of horrific experiences?
Well, Tule Lake was kind of the dumping ground for the problem, Japanese and the Japanese Americans. So there was a loyalty also that's passed around the various internment camps, and the internees had to sign their loyalty. And the way it was worded, it was very insulting. So some of these folks, they checked no, and they checked no on the two questions, which ended up shipping them off to Tule Lake oftentimes. If you weren't a U.S. citizen, then you were given the right to be repatriated back to Japan. And some families said, the heck with it. That's why you're going to treat us here in America. We're moving back, or we're moving the whole family back. So some of those folks, you know, left as very bitter, with a very bitter taste in their mouth, obviously. It was just not a good situation for anybody in the camps. So Tule Lake, you know, was probably one of the worst.
One quick question, Marlene Nesri, City Club member. And there was a question about how do you spell the UO Dean's name, who was instrumental in helping relocate some of the students' work to have that happen. We want to make sure we've got that right.
Onthank, O-N-T-H-A-N-K.
Okay,
Onthank.
Thank you. Thank you.
Carl with a K, correct.
Okay.
He was raised
in
Hood River.
Huh.
I believe he was a superintendent of schools there, and his daughter, Becky Berg, lives in Springfield, so we met her last month at the museum when we had a program there.
Great, thank you. And thank you so much for bringing clarity and vision to this important topic, when heroes are not welcomed home. And thanks again to our sponsors, Sacred Earth Botanicals, Capella Market, and Dot Dotson's Photography. We meet again on February 20th at the Downtown Athletic Club for Why Tests Are a Poor Lever for School Improvement with guest speaker Jerry Rosiak, University of Oregon College of Education. Lunches for this program can be ordered on City Club's website or by contacting the office. Thanks again, everyone, for being with us today.